And we'll be Nehemiah chapter 4. Over the past several weeks, we've been looking at the book of Nehemiah through the lens of this topic, the idea, the subject of spiritual focus, and what are the spiritual focal points in a Christian's life, and also doing that in a distracting world, in a world in which there are distractions from those focal points and opposition to kingdom work. So that has been our theme and in the 1 o'clock hour. And so we'll continue on with that in Nehemiah chapter 4. And we'll take the time to read this chapter. Now hear God's word. But so it happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren in the army of Samaria and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned?" Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders." So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and that the gaps were beginning to be closed, they became very angry. And all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. And then Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is failing, and there is so much rubbish that we're not able to build the wall." And our adversary said, "They will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease." So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came, and they told us 10 times, "From whatever place you turn, they will be upon us." Therefore, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the opening, and I set the people according to their families with their swords and their spears and their bows. And I looked, and I arose, and I said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses." And it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us, and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction, while the other half held the spears and the shields and the bows and wore armor. And the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. Then I said to the nobles, the rulers, and the rest of the people, "The work is great and extensive, and we are separated far from one another on the wall. Whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us." And so we labored in the work, and half the men held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. At the same time, I also said to the people, "Let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day." So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. We'll end our reading there. As I mentioned before, we have been talking about this theme of maintaining spiritual focus in a distracting world. And so far in Nehemiah, we've seen two focal points of the Christian life, and especially as exemplified in Nehemiah's life. Chapter 1 was the focal point of prayer. Remember that. We looked at Nehemiah's prayer and his prayer life. Chapter 3, we looked at the focus of kingdom work. And we saw the people with a mind, a united mind, building this wall together. So we've seen those spiritual focal points. But now in chapter 4, the second part of the theme starts to come into view, the distracting world part. Okay? Because we've seen that. We've seen the prayer and the work continue, and now they continue in the midst of distraction, or more specifically, opposition. So we've seen these spiritual focal points of prayer and kingdom work, and now we see the distracting world stepping in the way of that. The slanders and the doubts of the adversaries. Now let's look more closely at the distractions or the opposition in this case. It seems very extraordinary here in Nehemiah chapter 4. Not exactly the kind of distractions or even the kind of opposition that we very often face in life. An armed army of Ammonites and Ashdodites who are intent on keeping us from the work of the Lord. But at base, what we see in this chapter is the kind of pushback, the kind of pressure that kingdom work will always face in this world. It might not be so physical or tangible as it was to Nehemiah and his men in this chapter, but it's the kind of opposition that the work of the Lord will face in this life. The Lord Jesus told us to be ready for that, to be aware of that, that in the world you will have opposition, that men will slander and revile and persecute you and say all manner of evil falsely against you for my name's sake. He reminded us in no uncertain terms that that would be our experience. And yet, our calling continues, and the work of the kingdom must continue. Think about the cast of enemies that we see in our passage here in Nehemiah chapter 4. First, we have Sanballat from Samaria. Now, if you think of a map of Israel, Samaria lies to the north of Israel. You have Tobiah the Ammonite. Ammon was a place, a territory to the east of Israel, across the Jordan River. Then in verse 7, the Arabs are mentioned. The Arabs, of course, come from south of where Israel is. And then the Ashdodites are mentioned. Ashdod was an old Philistine city that's on the coast, which would be west of Israel. So all points of the compass are represented here in Nehemiah's opposition. North, south, east, and west. What we have here is a cross-section of the world's opposition to Christ's kingdom and the building of that kingdom. So there is Nehemiah, in a sense, doing the work of the kingdom, trying to build these walls of Jerusalem, and the world, in a sense, is opposing them from all directions. Now, what we'll notice in this chapter is these enemies of Nehemiah, they are men of words, not action. They threaten to attack, but they never actually do. What do they do instead? Instead, they taunt, they joke, they slander, and they ridicule. This is the enemy's oldest tactic. Even when he doesn't have enough courage to fight, he'll stand on the sidelines and ridicule. And I say, this is one of the enemy's oldest tactics. Think about the Psalms and how they portray the life of Christ and the ridicule and the slander that he had to undergo as part of his suffering and his humiliation. It was the words of men that he bore and crushed his spirit in some ways. And this is a preferred tactic of the enemies, the oldest tactic, because words can crush the spirit. Words do sting. And, sticks and stones can break your bones, but names can never hurt you. That doesn't really hold true. A lot of times it is words that can crush a man's spirit. And so this is a tactic that never really grows old. The enemy knows this, and this they still employ, a tactic that's alive and well today. Christianity and Christians are increasingly maligned with just such words in our own culture. And it's not simply the uncoordinated prejudices of a few vocal atheists. It's more systemic of the mind of the world itself, what the Apostle John called the spirit of the world. And sometimes that verbal opposition, right, that slander, whether it's on the television news, whether it's Sanballat and the Samaritans, or whoever it may be, With that, those words that hurt that come, it can cause God's people to shrink back, perhaps, and become timid or reluctant in the work of the kingdom. Because nobody likes to hear that. Nobody likes to be the object of that kind of slander. And that's what Sanballat was hoping. He was hoping to shame these people into apathy and kind of grind this work down to a halt. And it almost worked. Look at verse 10. Then Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is failing, and there's so much rubbish that we're not able to build the wall." It seems like there were people in Judah who echoed the same taunt of Sanballat in verse 2 when he was asking all these rhetorical questions. Will they revive these stones, heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned, and so on? Now, it seems like maybe some of his words were meeting their mark. Well, let's look at the actual slander of the enemy here in verse 2 of Sanballat. It's a series of rhetorical questions, isn't it? What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? I think the spirit of his question is, do these people expect a miracle? What are they trying to do? Right? They're trying to do something that looks quite impossible. Do they know what they're getting into? Trying to rebuild this place? And then he exaggerates their task. He calls the broken down wall heaps of rubbish. When earlier on, when Nehemiah surveyed the wall, he just noted that the walls were broken down. It wasn't a garbage heap, exactly. Just walls that needed repaired. So they make them feel as though this is this insurmountable task and they'll never get it done. It kind of reminds me of the rhetorical questions that Christians still do hear today. Do you really think you're going to change the world? I remember early in my own ministry when I was maybe... I was a young pastor, maybe 26 years old, 27, and I went to visit a man who was an alcoholic, had been for a long time in his life. And I went in there, his parents were there, and I talked to his father, who had been dealing with that for years. And here I was, this young pastor, dealing with this, trying to speak to and counsel this man who had been an alcoholic for his whole life. And his father said to me, "Do you really think that you're going to change him?" And I have to admit, those are words that shook me, that sort of met the mark. And I started to think, well, what? Maybe he's right. Maybe what am I doing here? Maybe I'm over my head, something like that. It's those kind of words, those kind of questions that we see here in Nehemiah chapter 4 that the enemy loves to use to sow doubt in the minds of God's people. Now, after Sanballat and all his rhetorical questions, then you have Tobiah the Ammonite, who is clearly second in command. And he hears Sanballat brag, and then in verse 3, he seems to want to get in on the sarcasm too. So he makes this really fatuous joke, this really dumb joke, right? They're going to build this wall, and even if a fox runs on it, the wall's going to fall over, which is, a really dumb joke. But it does show how slander is kind of a team sport, right? He heard the boss with all his big rhetorical questions, and he thought, well, he would get in on the act too and make this slanderous joke. But he really comes off as a lackey. He doesn't come off as tough as his boss did. But as I said, these comments of theirs didn't seem to miss the mark completely. It seems like the nerves of God's people were somewhat shaken. Again, verse 10, Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is failing." And then verse 11, "And our adversaries said, they will neither know or see anything till we come in the midst and kill them." And then in verse 12, "Then the Jews who dwelt near them came and said to us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us." At that point, it seemed like the work on the wall became very tenuous. It seemed like the slander may have had its effect. It seemed like the Judeans and the Jews in the countryside were having second thoughts about their ability to complete this wall. Now let's look at the response to all this, how Nehemiah specifically maintained his courage and maintained his focus upon doing the Lord's work in the midst of all this. verses 4 and 5. There's this sudden prayer that he prays, right? Just after Tobiah the Ammonite made his dumb joke about the fox on the wall, he says, Nehemiah, verse 4, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach upon their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity." It's like another arrow prayer. Remember from chapter 1, we saw that arrow prayer where he was in the midst of speaking to the king and he prayed in the middle of the conversation. Here's another one of those arrow prayers inserted right in the middle of this narrative. And it's so interesting because it's part of the narrative, and Nehemiah sort of takes us right back to that moment with this prayer to tell us what his prayer was right at that moment whenever he heard the slander of the enemy. He takes us right back to his prayer in his narration of the events. That was his response, which he recollected and made part of the narrative. Now, the lack of segue is so very powerful between Tobiah's dumb joke about the fox on the wall, right next to Nehemiah's prayer. That's a powerful juxtaposition, isn't it? Here's the enemy slandering and making a joke. And then the next verse without segue is Nehemiah's prayer, that God would hear them and respond to them and fight against their enemies. So there's a great contrast there between the sarcasm of the enemy and the prayer of Nehemiah. Nehemiah's reaction was not to respond in kind to his enemy, right? To not become part of that war of words, right? And to not respond in kind and hit back. Oh, yeah, if a mouse ran on your wall, it would fall over, that kind of thing. He doesn't do that. His instinct is not to fight back. His instinct is to turn to God and to seek God's grace. That was his reaction. That was his instinct. And that in itself, I think, is maybe one of the greatest lessons to take from this chapter. In the midst of that opposition, he doesn't respond in kind. He goes straight to God in prayer, seeking his grace. We have to remember that there will be obstacles and distractions and even opposition to whatever God calls us to do in this life. Whether it's, you know, the vocation that we have, however we serve the Lord, raising our families in a godly way, whatever we may have in this life to do that Christ gives us to do, there is going to be distraction and opposition from those things. But our response should always be to seek God's grace and to leave justice in the hands of God. And that's exactly what Nehemiah does in his prayer. When he says, "Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. And then, do not cover their iniquity and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders." Now, this is a somewhat imprecatory prayer. He's praying for God to exact vengeance upon his enemies. But he prays about God's justice. "They have provoked you," he says. He realizes that this is not a personal battle between him and his enemies, that these enemies of his are actually God's enemies. And so when he prays, it's not a personal vendetta, and he's not after personal vindication. He prays for God's justice for God's sake, because he realizes the ridicule that he faces is really directed toward God himself. And so he takes it that way, and he prays accordingly. Now, prayer is not his only response. Look at verse 6. "So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." Verse 6 begins, "So we built the wall." There is a powerful, sturdy, simple response to the opposition of the enemy. "So we did it anyway. So we built the wall." Appreciate the flow of this chapter, will you? The enemy's mocked. We prayed, and we built the wall anyway. Suddenly, Sanballat and his crew don't seem all that scary anymore. They don't seem, they seem insignificant, don't they? They seem pretty small. The enemy's words don't mean anything when God's people are prayerful and determined. And that's what we see in this passage. It said the people had a mind to work, and that Nehemiah and the people made their prayer to God. They were prayerful and determined, and in the face of a prayerful and determined people, the enemy suddenly seems pretty small and insignificant. Now, this nexus between prayer and action is a very important relationship in this chapter. And we see that as a pattern throughout this book, prayer followed by action. Always in that order, but the two never separated. This goes back to chapter 1. Remember, we heard Nehemiah's wonderful, great covenantal prayer. And then he approached the king with his request. We see it here in chapter 4, verses 4 and 6. We prayed, and then we built the wall. And we see it again here in verses 7, 8, and 9. Well, it happened when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed. They became angry, and all of them conspired together to come and to attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. There is the same nexus between prayer and action. We prayed, and we set a watch against them day and night. In fact, that great little phrase there in verse 9, we made our prayer, and we set a watch. I think that sort of encapsulates Nehemiah the man, and Nehemiah, his ministry. It's kind of a microcosm of his faith, because he seeks the Lord in prayer, and then he acts in faith. And that's always what you see him doing. That's what we see him doing here. It was reflected in chapter 1, chapter 3, and now chapter 4. Here it says, we prayed and we set a watch. It teaches us a few things. Number one, that prayer is no escape. Prayer is a precursor to action, because we know that prayers are answered by means in this life. When Nehemiah prayed, he expected to work. When he prayed for protection, he expected to hold a weapon. When he prayed for the walls to be built, he expected to lift stones and do the work. So his prayer was always a precursor to determined action. Now, this business of taking up a watch against them and the workforce being armed and so on, in one sense, you can think of Psalm 3. And this passage made me think of Psalm 3, because there the psalmist says, even if thousands, 10,000 were surrounding him, he would still lay down and sleep peacefully because he knew that the Lord was protecting him. Nehemiah doesn't exactly do that here. He doesn't just lay down and sleep, even though the enemies are surrounding the wall. He sets a watch. I think Psalm 3 and Nehemiah 4 are giving us two different points, obviously. Psalm 3 talking about that inward disposition of peace that we can always have because the Lord is with us, no matter what circumstances. Nehemiah 4 shows us that in various circumstances in life, there is some good sanctified common sense to use when the enemy is surrounding your walls. You arm yourself and set a watch. I think that comparison and contrast teaches us that spiritual realities should not leave us apathetic. Yes, God is our protector, but you still set a watch. God is sovereign over all things, but you still work and pray. And that's the lesson that we're seeing here. These great truths that we know about God do not leave his people apathetic. And we certainly see that in Nehemiah's life. Now, as I said, verses 10, 11, and 12 seem to be that tenuous point where there seems to be doubt or misgivings about the ability to complete the task. And that almost seems to embolden the enemy. In verse 10, 11, and 12, I want you to look there because there are three different speakers in quick succession. Verse 10, Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing. Verse 11, our adversaries said, they will neither know or see anything till we kill them. Verse 12, the Jews who dwelt near them said, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. So Judah said this, we don't know if we can do this. The adversary said, we're going to kill you. And then the Jews surrounding said, they're going to get us. It's just one after another. And this cacophony of words all taking place at the same time. Talk about doubt. Talk about opposition. Talk about a project taking place in the midst of doubt and opposition. This is it, right? Now, in the midst of all that, you cannot help but wonder if Nehemiah himself felt a little bit isolated. I think he did. Look at what he says in verse 13. Therefore, I position men behind the lower parts of the wall. He moves to the first person pronoun now for the first time, as if it were all up to him. Previously in this chapter, it's all we. It's all the plural pronoun. Look at verse 1. We were rebuilding the wall. Look at verse 6. So we built the wall. Verse 9. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to God. And then suddenly in verse 13, he's down to I. It seems like perhaps he was or felt a little bit isolated as a leader of the people. The we got slowly reduced to the I. And I think the point here is that kingdom work will sometimes take a man out on a limb, as it did with Nehemiah. You can't always expect popular support, and Nehemiah wasn't getting it at this point. The men of Judah, the Jews of the countryside, everybody had their doubts. Everybody was throwing their 2 cents in. Sometimes the we will be reduced to an I, as it is in verse 13. But beside the plural and singular contrast, there's another contrast here between words and actions. I already pointed out verse 10, 11, and 12, three different speakers. Judah said this. The enemy said this. The surrounding Jews said this. Three times it says, they said this, they said this, they said this. But then in response to that, and it says in verse 13, therefore, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall. They said this, they said this, they said this, so I did this. This is where Nehemiah himself starts to stand out as a man of prayer and action, as a man of spiritual focus, not a man of words, but a man of prayer and action. He doesn't partake in the cacophony of words. He prays and he works. He's not distracted or worried about the enemy's threats and their taunts. He doesn't indulge the doubts of his own countrymen. He prays and then he simply figures out the next step to take. That is a sturdy model of spiritual focus and spiritual leadership. Let me digress for just a moment to apply this point in a very particular way, especially to people who are in positions of leadership or positions of headship in the church or in the family. That would mean elders, pastors, that would mean fathers and husbands, people who find themselves in a position of authority or headship. There's an important point to be seen here in this passage. Do you think Nehemiah was worried at all during the midst of this project? I bet he was. But you would not know it at all from reading this text. He knew in his heart that the people around him needed him to be strong and to be calm and to be prayerful and to be persistent as a leader. And that's exactly what we see. And so he never once involves himself in the petty spat of words with the enemy. He doesn't indulge the doubts of his own countrymen. He doesn't indulge in his own doubts or fears, which I'm sure he must have had. He simply prays, and then he figures out the next step to take. It's the kind of prayerful focus that a family needs from a father and husband. It's the kind of prayerful focus that a church needs from its leaders and its officers, from all kinds of men in authority. There used to be a poster, a British World War II poster, propaganda poster that was put up all around the city of London that said, stay calm and carry on. And it's been popularized these days. You see it again here and there. And that's a pretty good motto if you think about it, stay calm and carry on. But I would add one more thing, pray, stay calm and carry on, which is precisely what Nehemiah does in this chapter. He prays, he stays calm, and he carries on. And you can see how that prayerful determination is blessed and established in this chapter. Now let's have a look very briefly at this point in action with Nehemiah as a leader, especially in Nehemiah's rallying cry to the people in verse 14. Look what it says in verse 14 with me. First of all, notice the wonderful progression of verbs here. I looked and arose and I said. There is such intentionality in that sequence of verbs. I looked. He looked around him. He rose to the situation and he spoke. Right? So there's wonderful intentionality there in verse 14. Now let's look at what he said. He said to everyone, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, for your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Now, remember the word remember. Remember in chapter 1 how that was a key word. We looked at Nehemiah's prayer, and his key word to God was remember. Remember your covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That was a key prayer word for Nehemiah and a key prayer word in all of Scripture. People just pray to God, remember your promise, remember your people, remember your covenant, remember your own name, remember. Now Nehemiah says to the people, remember the Lord great and awesome. Now this becomes his appeal to the people to remember God, to remember his character. That is supposed to be their motivation. So to God, he says, remember your covenant. To the people, he says, remember your God. Everyone is being urged to remember each other, remember their obligations, remember. This is the motive for kingdom work. Remember the Lord, great and awesome. That's why you're doing what you're doing. The Lord is great and awesome. Remember that. That is a motive like no other for the work of the kingdom. Nehemiah seeks to instill that grand motive back in them, the character of God himself. This is why you do what you do. Because they may have lost sight of it in the midst of that work. Think about that mundane work of building a wall and putting stone, one stone upon the next and so on. Yeah, you'd get a little tired and you'd forget any great principle that might have been in your mind of why you're doing it. And so he's telling them, remember why, remember God's character. We too, in the work of the kingdom, we too, in the Christian life, might lose sight of that grand motive in the many small things that make up our service to Christ. We can lose sight of that great motive of the character of God himself. And so we need to hear that rallying cry as well. Remember the Lord, great and awesome. And that's why he tells them to remember, because it's easy for us to forget how great and awesome God is and why that in itself is our motive to serve him. Now, the second part of Nehemiah's appeal focuses on family and community. Look at what he said. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, and your wives, and your houses. Now, Nehemiah remembers in proper order the two great priorities in life, the two great motives that we should have instilled in us. The vertical plane first and the horizontal plane second. Those two planes that make up our loyalties as Christians. God himself first, the great and awesome God. And then what? Church and family. That's precisely what Nehemiah appeals to. If these things are not worth fighting for, then nothing is. We've been talking about spiritual focus in a distracting world. And focus rests upon motive. You will never find, I think, anywhere in all of Holy Scripture, a better summary of what our focus and our motive should be than in verse 14 of Nehemiah chapter 4. Great and awesome God, your brethren, your family. God, family, church. Everything else beside that is a distraction. Everything we do in life should be for the glory of God, for the good of his people. These are the basic priorities of life. God, his people, and the covenant family. And Nehemiah brings them back to these basic priorities, those things that make us tick as Christians, right? And that's what spiritual focus is. A simple matter of basic motives, basic priorities that make us tick. The glory of God, the good of His people. That is spiritual focus. I'm also struck by Nehemiah's appeal to sons and daughters and wives and homes. That's something to acknowledge as a powerful and as a proper motive for serving the Lord. Because doing what God calls us to do, living the Christian life and serving Him, is in fact a blessing to family as well. The wall that they were building here in Nehemiah chapter 4, after all, was to protect their families and their homes. But this is indeed true of all kingdom work. Because, I mean, picture our own work of the kingdom. Let's just go metaphorical for a moment. Picture that as building a wall. Your home and your family are inside that wall. They're part of that kingdom work. They benefit from that. They are blessed from that. Because everything that's done for God's glory is going to be good for the church. Whatever's good for the church is good for the family circle too. Because the family is in the church and the church exists for the glory of God. All of these motives are interconnected. And verse 14 is a powerful and a memorable recognition of this. That when you labor for God's glory, you do so also for His people and for the covenant family. Now, the rest of this chapter is about the fighting workforce, right? The men who worked with one hand and held a weapon in the other. And it reminds us that there are times and there are places in redemptive history when just war and self-defense are part of the experience of the church in a fallen world. However, Nehemiah acknowledged that their warfare ultimately was spiritual, and ultimately their weapons were not carnal. Look what he says in verse 20. Whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us, he says. Now, that's a wonderful counterpart to what he says, you know, back in verse 14, when he tells them to fight. Right? He tells them to fight for your brethren, fight for your sons and your daughters. He tells them to fight. But then in verse 20, he says, our God will fight for us. It shows that they were not relying on the weapons of war, their own strength, but they knew that the Lord's will would be decisive in any confrontation, and they trusted in Him ultimately and not themselves. Now, in conclusion, think of this chapter as a whole in terms of today's theme, if you will. Opposition to kingdom work, maintaining spiritual focus in the face of opposition to kingdom work. All right. Think about it in those terms. So in that paradigm, what do we see here? What unfolds? The people had a task. There were obstacles. There were oppositions. They prayed, they worked, and the task was finished. The wall was done. They were able to complete it. So I guess the point is that the obstacles of the world are not as scary as they seem, and they are no match for God's will. God's will is always done. But you and I live in the middle of that messy process from day to day, trying to serve the Lord, dealing with doubts and distractions and opposition. Our task may not be so tangible as building a wall, and our obstacles are not often as tangible as an army of angry Ammonites. But the keys to spiritual focus remain simple and consistent. It is simple. It's nothing flashy and nothing innovative. It's not clever and it's not programmatic. Spiritual focus takes spiritual discipline, founded upon the right motives, the glory of God, and the good of His people. Nehemiah chapter 4 shows us that much, that when the Lord gives you a task to do, and He gives you the strength to do it, that we must fix our hearts upon it. seek His grace, and be men of prayer and men of focus. And even in the smallest task or the most humble service that we render to Christ, we need to lay hold of this great motive. Remember the Lord great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters. Now that high rhetoric is a rallying cry to great action, isn't it? Remember the Lord great and awesome, fight for your brethren. Yeah, that's a rallying cry to great deeds. But if you in your life, if you do what you do for no less a reason as that, then the work of your hands will truly be established. And it will be no less important if you do what you do for the glory of God and for the good of His people. To have that spiritual focus will make us truly useful in the hands of God. Let's pray.